I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of September 7th, 2012. You've always heard that student debt is the one thing you cannot get rid of in bankruptcy. Well, it turns out there are exceptions, but not very many of them.
You can only walk away from your debt and get your student loan debt discharged if you can prove that paying it back would cause you what they called an undue hardship, but they never defined the term.
We'll hear what the courts are saying to people who declare themselves hopeless. It's always easy to feel like you never have enough money. Even wealthy people claim there's just never enough. Why?
Most of us have been taught, first of all, that money's a result, not that money is what it really is. It's an actual tool to be used to create the life, the world, the community, the family, etc., that we want. It's a tool.
Actor Hill Harper on curing our financial ills. And we'll hear from a married couple about what it's like to have a relationship that moonlights as a business partnership. It's coming up on Marketplace Money from APM.
This podcast is supported by Ting.com. Ting gives you big savings for mobile phone service. Try their online savings calculator and save $50 on your device purchase at marketplace.ting.com.
Hurricane Isaac has had its day and its way with the Gulf states. Now it's time for the cleanup. And with that, the insurance reckoning. Lots of homeowners will probably find out they don't have the insurance coverage they thought they had. And that's because in areas threatened by natural disaster, more and more companies have been whittling away at benefits. Some have even withdrawn coverage altogether. Dan Bobkoff has our story.
Andy O'Connor has twice lost a home to fire. The first time, she was 12. The second time was 2 years ago. It was Labor Day. She was kayaking hundreds of miles away when a friend told her about a wildfire near O'Connor's home on a Colorado mountain. The next day, a neighbor drove to the top of a nearby mountain with her binoculars.
And she called me that night, and she said, "The surrounding houses are okay, but all that's left of your house is a foundation."
It would become known as the 4 Mile Canyon Fire, one of the more costly wildfires in Colorado history. Days later, O'Connor returned to the site.
Absolutely, absolutely nothing was left. Everything was in pieces.
O'Connor had bought her house nearly 2 decades ago. Back then, she didn't think much about insurance. Her realtor shared a building with an insurance company, so as soon as she closed on the house, her realtor took her upstairs, where an agent entered the info and out popped a policy.
And I looked at the premium, and it was really reasonable, so I signed it, and I said, "Great. There's my homeowner's insurance." And I didn't think about it again for about 15 years.
That's typical. Most of us don't think about our insurance unless something happens. Who wants to? O'Connor says every time the insurance company sent her an update letter, she'd toss it in a file. After the fire, she discovered she didn't have enough coverage to replace both the house and everything in it. She's not alone. Amy Bach heads United Policyholders, a consumer group.
The trend is less coverage for more money, but it's also more complicated coverage.
The recent wildfires, hailstorms, and hurricanes are leading to higher premiums across the country. But insurance is competitive, and companies don't want to hike prices too much. So instead, some companies are reducing coverage little by little. Daniel Schwartz studies the industry at the University of Minnesota, and he says consumers need to pay attention.
They might find that they don't have mold coverage, even though some other policies do. They might find that their policy doesn't cover increased costs that are going to be incurred in rebuilding.
Some policies have tweaked wording. Instead of saying like, it might now say equivalent when describing what the policy will pay to replace. You might not hear the difference, but like is better for a homeowner. Equivalent is better for the insurer.
Homeowners insurance in particular is an extraordinarily competitive market.
Jean Salvatore is with the Insurance Information Institute. She says because it's so competitive, there's no incentive to give their customers short shrift.
There are a lot of companies, and then companies offer different types of products.
And the industry says it always tells consumers when it makes changes to their policies. But consumer advocate Amy Bach says that news is usually confusing.
They always seem to package it in a candy-coated wrapper saying, "Now your policy is a premium policy. Good news. And we have made some changes." And then the consumer just sees good news, and they're not going to read the fine print. And even if they do, they're not going to understand it.
So we're here in my new house, which is mostly finished.
2 years after a wildfire took her home, Andy O'Connor has rebuilt on the same site tucked into a mountain near Boulder. A
couple of doors that don't have doorknobs, but the house is mostly finished.
Since then, she's become an insurance expert.
Here's the big, big file that says policy.
She spent an entire weekend poring over her policy and even hired an attorney to explain what it all means. Soon, she'll be updating her insurance for the new place. This time, she hopes to know exactly what she's getting. I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
It's one of the first rules of personal finance. Keep it simple. And that goes from everything from insurance to investing. Commentator Chris Farrell wishes the same rule applied to financial regulation.
What do dogs, frisbees, bank regulation, and managing your money at home have in common? A lot, it turns out. Let me explain. It starts with a speech on regulation given by two economists at last week's meeting for central bankers in Jackson Hole. The title? The Dog and the Frisbee. As they pointed out, the underlying physics of catching a frisbee is pretty complex. It takes PhD-type calculations to figure out. But the act of catching a frisbee is easy. Even dogs can do it well. The secret to the dog's success, and ours? Keep it simple. Without thinking about it, we move at a speed that keeps the angle of our gaze to the frisbee roughly constant. Now that's kind of cool, but what does it have to do with bank regulation? Well, a financial crisis is an incredibly complex event, and preventing one is really hard. The basic impulse among legislators and regulators is this: solving a complex financial problem requires regulatory complexity. With each crisis, we add more regulators and more rules. Problem is, applying increasingly complex rules in an increasingly complex financial environment doesn't work. Remember the lesson of the frisbee and the dog. Keep it simple. A handful of well-thought-out yet simple rules is a far better approach. With financial regulation, less is more. The same less is more strategy holds for managing our own money. The risks and rewards of simple investments and simple strategies are easy to grasp. The expenses associated with plain vanilla products are low. Put it this way. Many of the complex financial products and high-priced, cutting-edge, money-making tactics manufactured by the financial services industry over the past 3 decades have turned out to be bad for your financial health. Keep it simple, and you'll have more time to play Frisbee.
Chris Farrell is the economics correspondent for Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Ting, the new mobile service that makes sense, bringing billing clarity, usability, and savings to mobile phone users. Ting bills megabytes, minutes, and text messages separately. If you use less than anticipated, the difference is credited at the end of the month. Ting has no premiums or penalties. You don't pay for more than you use. Save $50 on your device at marketplace.ting.com. That's marketplace.ting.com.
If you're in the market for a car, there may not be a better time to go get one. Of course, we hope you do lots of homework first, figure out what make and model are best for you, then read up on how to get through that whole showroom ordeal. But apparently, plenty of folks agree it's a good time to buy a car because we bought 20% more of them last month than we did in August of last year. Our friend Phil Reed of Edmunds.com joins me to talk about all this. Welcome back.
Good to see you, Tess.
We haven't talked in, I think, about a year and a half. And boy, I tell you, since then, people have been buying up cars left and right.
Absolutely. I mean, just this last month, it broke all kinds of records. And we're on track for something like 14 million vehicles sold. And that's basically going back to the good old days. I mean, when I first started in the business 12 years ago, annual sales were 16 million. So we're getting close to that.
So what's happening?
Well, it's kind of a confluence of a number of things, one of which is low interest rate, but there's also a relaxation of the credit requirements. Because in 2008, when the auto industry tanked, boy, I mean, you couldn't get a car loan. Mm-hmm. And since then, they've been gradually relaxing it. There's a couple of other factors, among which are September is usually a very active time because the new models are coming onto the car lot. Hmm. So they both have both 2013 and 2012 models. So there's a lot of excitement, and this is an exciting and active time on the car lots.
I particularly wanted to ask you about these incentives where you don't have to put any money down and you have 0% financing for up to 5, even 6 years. Who is getting that kind of deal? Anybody really getting that?
Yes, they are, and it saves an enormous amount of money. I did a calculation here, and I chose the Ford Fusion to prove that I'm patriotic in this election
Go
season.
America.
Yes, yes, right. This is a car that you can purchase for $22,300. It's the 2012 model. You're going to be paying $1,900 in tax. And there's $3,000 back. So you're going to be financing $21,000. If you got 0% financing, your monthly payment would be $360 for 60 months. And to compare that to sort of a more average rate, because this is like a second tier rate, would mm-hmm. be 6.9%, then your payment would be $427 over 5 years. And the difference there is nearly $3,000.
Wow, $3,000 over 5 years for interest.
And that's flat out money that could be saved as a result of being, you know, knowing that this interest rate is available, knowing that you qualify for it. So that's enormous.
How do you negotiate that kind of game playing that goes on with the interest rate when you're at the dealership? If you're not one of those people who's able to get this 0% that everybody's advertising,
right,
how do you come up with that number?
Yeah. Well, there's two things. I mean, very often you hear people say, check your credit score. And mm-hmm. you should check your credit score, know where you stand and so on. But actually a practical piece of advice is to actually apply for independent financing. You can apply online and get approved or get a response in 15 minutes or so. Okay, now let's say that you are pre-approved at 4.5%. It's sort of like a defense when you go into the dealership.
Yeah.
Because essentially you can say, you know, I'm a cash buyer. I'm ready just to talk about the price of the car. So you don't have to play the monthly payment game. That really helps. Now, what happens is you go into the finance and insurance office and they say, okay, where's your briefcase full of cash? You know, and as well, here's a pre-approved check. They'll take one look at your check and they'll say, what's your interest rate? 4.5%. If I beat it, will you finance with us? Well, you know that you're protected. You're not going to be taken advantage of, and they're going to have to give you a substantially better deal. So that's a very quick and easy and non-confrontational way to negotiate for the interest rate.
Can't you play off that interest rate versus the purchase price of the car? I mean, all of that is negotiable, right?
Absolutely. There's a lot of moving pieces when you go to buy a car, and that's one of the things that makes it very difficult for people because they try to hang on to just one or two of the pieces. And if they're hanging on to those, meanwhile, behind the curtain, or you know, the shell game is being played.
All right. Phil Reed is a senior consumer advice editor at Edmunds.com. Good friend of the show. Good to see you again.
Good to see you. Thanks a lot.
Well, that is it for summer, I guess. It's back to work for most of us. Sorry to make you think about work on a weekend, but commentator Teresa Amabile, well, she has a question for you. Who plays a bigger role in your happiness at the office, the boss or your coworkers?
The corporate environment you experience at work every day is actually a combination of two factors. There's the local environment, your own team of coworkers, and then there's the wider organizational environment, the top brass and everyone else. When my research team and I studied 26 teams of professionals in 7 companies, we found that generally the work environments of the team and the organization matched, whether good or bad. But for 6 of those teams, their local environment was either much worse or much better than the organizational environment. Our analysis of day-by-day mood and motivation for those 6 teams found that the organizational context, such as top management criticism, was overshadowed by the local, things like a team leader's encouragement and coworker's support. Bad dynamics at the local level can make you miserable and undermine your performance. In one of the teams we studied, nearly everyone hated coming to work, even though the organizational environment was okay. Two mechanical engineers on the team saw each other as rivals and never agreed on even the simplest decisions. They sniped at each other constantly. The team leader was ineffectual at stemming the conflict, and progress for the entire group slowed to a crawl. In another of our teams, people had great relationships, which buffered them from a truly toxic organizational environment. Although top management was dismissive most of the time, the team supported each other's work and had fun together to boot. When one of them came back from vacation sunburned, they hung a plastic lobster over her desk, amusing her and everyone else. And when another member told us how the team rallied to pull off a seemingly impossible project, he ended by saying, "God help me, I do love them so." So, love them or not, those people you see every day at work loom much larger in your day-to-day happiness and performance than whoever sits in the C-suite.
Teresa Amabile is a professor at Harvard Business School and co-author of The Progress Principle. Well, here's one way to make people happy at work. Pay them more. Or at least, if they're women, pay them the same as what the guys are making for the same work. That is not happening in Louisiana, which has one of the worst records in the nation when it comes to pay disparity. But a new coastal restoration project funded by penalty money from the BP oil spill could provide lots of jobs with proper pay. It's part of the Restore Act, passed in late June, channeling millions of dollars to businesses along the Gulf Coast. Reporter Zoe Sullivan has this story from Louisiana.
Victoria Elfer is the picture of hard work and determination. She grew up and lives just outside of New Orleans and is committed to making a good life there.
Well, the work that I do right now, I'm an office manager at a collision and mechanic shop, and I also bartend part-time.
We meet at a car show, where some of the vintage cars repaired in her shop are competing for honors.
I was an office manager. I earn, I think, a little less than $30,000 a year. And then bartending part-time, that just helps out with income because I have a mortgage, because I bought my first house last year when I was 22.
Elfer also supports her mother, who has health issues.
And I have a son, so I have a three-year-old.
On top of the two jobs, her mother and her young son, Elfer's also putting herself through school. She's fascinated by the snakes in Louisiana's wetlands, and she wants to get a PhD to focus specifically on serpents. Now that the Restore Act has passed, Elfer may just be in the right place at the right time, since millions of dollars will go into rebuilding the Mississippi River Delta. The Delta is currently losing land faster than any other place on Earth, endangering cities and towns, and all the local industry that depends on the wetlands. But will women get hired for coastal restoration jobs, even if they do have the qualifications?
When I go through every single occupation, if I go through every single industry, and I go through every single category of worker, women earn less than men. And that is across the board.
Beth Willinger is a sociologist who studied the pay disparity between men and women in Louisiana for years. Women in Louisiana earn less than men, even when they're doing the same work.
What we find is in Louisiana that there are very traditional ideas about the work of women and the work of men. And so we see still a very sex-segregated labor force.
So how do you change the status quo? Policy reform is one way. This year, the Louisiana State Legislature discussed two bills to mandate equal pay for equal work. Karen Carter Peterson is a Democratic state senator from New Orleans. She introduced one of those bills. She doubts that the pay disparity between men and women will really change with coastal restoration jobs.
Opportunity, yes. Do I have confidence that the state of Louisiana at this point will step up and do the right thing? I can't say that I do right now.
Roughly a dozen women I reached out to for this story declined to be interviewed, in at least one case because her employer asked her not to talk. Margot Moss was an exception. Moss is 26, and her dark blonde hair is cut in a perky bob. She's petite, but not a pushover. She works for an environmental engineering firm, which happens to be owned by a woman. Moss does field work in the wetlands, but she also helps her company bring in new business.
You know, being a woman has its advantages and disadvantages. And I hate to say it, but, you know, if you own some other large I don't know, marine insurance company, and some, you know, 26-year-old girl walks up to you, you're going to maybe pay attention to them more.
But Moss said being a young woman can be a challenge. When she first got out of college, she discovered what it's like to work on one of those big oil rigs, miles out into the Gulf of Mexico.
I mean, talk about being a woman, man. I was out on some rigs that were like, you know, you get helicoptered out an hour out. It's like me and 100 guys.
What was that like?
Oh, I got asked a lot, like, what you doing out here, little girl?
Moss is still a minority among coastal restoration workers. But those Restore Act dollars mean a lot of money will be going to fix the Gulf Coast. Those funds could employ more women like Moss and decrease Louisiana's pay disparity, as long as those restoration jobs pay men and women equally. In New Orleans, I'm Zoe Sullivan for Marketplace.
Here's one thing I've learned in my 22 years in the workforce. No matter how unhappy you are at the office, no matter how upset you are about your pay or anything else, one thing you must never, ever do is cry about it at work, and definitely not in front of the boss. Unfortunately, I have broken that rule more than once, but maybe things are changing. Sheryl Sandberg told the Harvard Business School commencement this year that she turned on the waterworks at Facebook, and she's the COO.
I've cried at work. I've told people I've cried at work, and this got reported in the press as Sheryl Sandberg cried on Mark Zuckerberg's shoulder, which is not exactly what happened. I talk about my hopes and fears, and I ask people about theirs. I try to be myself, honest about my strengths and weaknesses, and I encourage others to do the same.
I wouldn't cry into a hoodie either. Well, to talk about the taboo of tears in the workplace, I've invited Ann Kramer. She's author of It's Always Personal, Emotion in the New Workplace. Welcome, Ann.
Hi, great to be here.
You touch on a lot of different emotions that can kind of take people over at work, but I wanted to focus on this idea of crying. Do you think that crying at work is any more acceptable now than it has been in the past?
I think there is a level of acceptance that's surrounding it. In my book, I did a ton of research around the subject, and in a giant national survey that I conducted, it turned out that 41% of women reported that they had cried during the last year in the workplace, and 9% of men. And a surprising finding was that crying made no difference whatsoever in terms of a person's success. People at all levels of management reported that they had cried. And I thought that that was something that was fresh and new, in fact.
Yeah, it's very counterintuitive because, I mean, particularly as a woman, I think we always get the message that that is the absolute worst possible thing that you could possibly do in the office.
Well, it is, in fact. I mean, I think we're told when we go into the workforce, whatever you do, do not let them see you cry. And in fact, one of the things I wanted to do was to find out if that sort of admonition was something that was socially conditioned or if it was sort of deeper than that. And I discovered that, in fact, women's tear ducts are anatomically different from men's tear ducts. They're smaller. So when we cry, the tears tend to sort of stream out and down our face, and when men sort of feel emotional in the same way, they just well up. And so they might be feeling exactly the same degree of distress that we are, but it doesn't show as much, which I found fascinating.
That is fascinating. Where do you think, then, this negative association with crying came from?
Well, I think when women entered the workforce, the dominant sort of sector obviously was male. And I think that there is acculturation of men in the workplace that, you know, hail fellow, well met, stand up, be strong. And women had to adapt to that norm when they entered the workplace or risk being sort of ostracized in some way.
I wonder if there are certain offices, certain types of jobs where you could perhaps be a little more open about crying, that are more open to tears or at least emotion than others?
Well, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, I think if you work within, I did a large talk in Washington in front of a group of military people. And in fact, one of the things they talked about was how difficult it was for them in the, you know, armed forces to express any kind of emotion in that kind of chain and command environment. Whereas, you know, the entertainment industry, which is where I came from, it's far more, I think, tolerated. But I think the question is that tears are like the check engine light on your car dashboard, kind of. When you feel yourself about to cry, it's telling you something. You're frustrated, you're overworked, you're feeling undervalued, you don't have enough resources. It's a real tool for analysis. It can actually help you kind of perform your work more successfully if instead of ignoring and tamping down the tears, you kind of say, oh, wow, what is this telling me? And it's good for both the employee and the manager in that situation to think about it.
What about the way that male and female managers react to the act of crying in their office?
Well, it was fascinating to me. I mean, one would think that women would be more kind of forgiving and understanding of others doing the same thing, given the fact that we are basically wired in this capacity. And in fact, what I found in my research is that men were basically fine when a woman cried in front of them. Obviously, this is not if they're doing it constantly, but if there were an occasional tear, it was like, oh, that's what kind of happens, fine, whatever. They moved on. Women viewed it as an unforgivable sin to have done it. They were far harsher against other women than they were against men who actually might tear up in the workplace.
And was there a reason behind that?
You know, I mean, emotions are this sort of evolutionary thing. We were hardwired to, under threat, with these hormones coursing through us, escape the threat. Well, we don't live in physically threatening environments or work in physically threatening environments by and large. They are cognitive environments. And we're lagging behind the kind of coping mechanisms to figure out how to adjust and respond to that. And I think women are still frightened that if they show that, it will be, bad for their careers.
Ann Kramer is the author of It's Always Personal, Emotion in the New Workplace. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Liz. Great.
Before we leave the subject of work and happiness, how happy would you be working with your spouse? Well, plenty of people do it. The Small Business Administration says almost 90% of U.S. businesses are family-owned or controlled, though it does not break out how many couples work together. But managing a relationship is already a delicate business. Throw money into the mix, and things can get just even a little more complicated. Marketplace's Nancy Fargali reports.
Wing and Hollow is playing a six-song set. In between the music comes the banter.
I'm sensing a little attitude from you. I don't know if it's just right now or...
That's crazy.
Sorry for the squabble on stage. Probably really inappropriate.
It might be inappropriate, except they're married. Jill Lamoureux is the vocalist, and her husband, Haven, plays the guitar. They've been married for almost 2 years. She's a classically trained singer. He's a self-taught musician. Tonight, they're in a small L.A. bar performing songs off their second album, North of Nowhere, which they wrote and distributed by themselves. It's their family business.
Thank you so much. Two more songs for you tonight. It's been such a pleasure.
There are about 15 folks in the audience. They paid $8 each. Wing and Hollow splits the take with the bar if they can clear a certain number of tickets. Tonight, they didn't make any money. They're a professional act, but their band doesn't generate enough to live on, so they have other jobs. Jill has a regular singing gig at an L.A. hotel. She usually earns $200 an hour. And Haven edits and directs documentaries. His day rate averages about $675. Still, they know they are on the working class side of the music equation right now.
So here we are in the dining room / office / major / music room. As you can see, there's instruments everywhere.
This is a little mandolin. I don't know. Ouch. I don't know.
And 7 guitars, a tambourine, a drum pad, a keyboard, a computer, and an amp. All in this one-bedroom apartment, which is home, which is the office where your coworker is your spouse and where you write, fiddle, tweak, and practice.
Cage a bird just to hear him sing. Realize no one's listening. Free the bird just to shoot him down.
A lot of people might look at it and be like, I would never want to work with my spouse. I would never want to have a day-to-day thing and then come home to them. And all I've done is spent the whole day with them or all these hours with them. It's like marriage on steroids.
Like marriage, Jill says writing music is emotional. Your personalities can come out. You'll have moments of collision.
We're both so emotionally invested in the music that we write, and we want it to be so good. And we can get in arguments and get frustrated because that's just part of the songwriting process.
I think one of the difficulties in working together so closely is knowing when it's time to write and when it's time not to write. For me, I'm always playing the guitar around the house. And I think I push it a little bit hard sometimes into a time where I feel like, okay, let's constantly be writing. And Joe's like, well, let's just be married right now, you know? And I for me, I have to find time to go, okay, cool. This is marriage and this is music.
Their dream is to play full-time as Wing and Hollow, but it's not cheap putting out your own product. It cost almost $3,000 to produce their second CD, and then another $1,000 to mass-produce. They've played 12 shows this year, and they've come close to recouping the album costs, but it takes a lot of work. They book their own shows, they do their own marketing. The platforms have increased, so has the workload and the financial investment.
The costs kind of start piling up, but then it's up to you. Once you have it, 7 boxes filled with 1,000 CDs show up at your house, and you're like, oh, okay, so where do we go from here? You know, you keep pushing the boulder up the hill in a sense.
If it was a boulder that we were trying to push up a hill, that would be something that we didn't want to do. And instead, I just think of it as a stepping stone. It's not the last album we're going to make, and we know that.
And both agree you spend money on what you love and hope one day you can get that money back. I'm Nancy Fregali for Marketplace.
Every day we face big decisions, milk or cream. Bus or car, gym or happy hour. But a lot of the tougher decisions, well, those appear in our finances. Jack Otter tries to help with those decisions in his book, Worth It, Not Worth It, Simple and Profitable Answers to Life's Tough Financial Questions. He's also executive editor of CBSMoneyWatch.com. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So this really seems to boil down to the idea of, cost-benefit analysis, right?
Absolutely. And really, part of the cost-benefit analysis is that people aren't willing to spend the time to learn the sort of stuff you need to answer financial questions. And so I tried to reduce that time so it didn't seem so expensive. You and I both know some wonderful writers, you know, who've written really smart books on all this stuff. But people, unfortunately, aren't willing to put in that time. And I do have some sympathy for people. They're very, very busy. And when somebody wants to sit down and read a big book, it's The Sun Also Rises. It's not a book that tells you about mutual funds.
I wonder if we have to look at the advice that has been given over the last several decades. It all is pretty much the same advice. You have boiled it down here to 2-page, very easy to understand areas. But there's something going on here where the message is still not getting through because people make the same mistakes over and over and over again. Any speculation on what that is?
First of all, there is some bad information. When I sat down to write this, I scanned some other books, ones who actually had a lot of really bad information in them. Mm. So that is part of it. And frankly, that bad information was usually information that somebody has a financial interest in getting out there. Our actively managed mutual funds get 12% a year. There's a well-known bestseller, actually, that says that. Another issue is that it's behavioral. There's a lot of things that we are pre-programmed to believe, or little biases that we have that turn out not to be true when you really look at it intellectually. And so it's just tough to resist because money's a very emotional issue. As much as we all want to boil it down to mathematics,
right,
most of our decisions actually are emotional, and often that leads us to the wrong place.
Well, let's go with a couple of the categories that you have in this book and just maybe find out how you came to the conclusion of whether it was worth it or not worth it.
Sure.
Move in with parents versus live in squalor. This seems pretty easy to me.
Well, it depends on your priorities. I set up as a formula where you have to weigh the different values. And so, for instance, walking in at 8:30 in the morning and explaining to your mom where you've been could be very painful for some people. On the other hand, it might be even more painful to walk into the bathroom of the hovel you share with six other people and find your toothbrush in a different place every morning.
Ew. Okay. Yeah. Hmm. Cashback credit cards versus travel rewards cards. This is a question that we get quite often.
So on that one, it's pretty clear mathematically that the cash back cards are better. However, I do admit in the book that I make the non-mathematical decision for myself, which is to go to the travel rewards cards because I do mental accounting, which is a bad thing to do. But I really enjoy the fact that I can buy, quote unquote, these miles for free and go on vacation thinking I didn't really pay for these airline tickets.
Okay. All right. So some very sound advice there. But we thought we'd also see if we could stump you with some questions that perhaps didn't make it into the book. How about a little lightning round? You up for that?
Sounds good.
Okay. Well, let us know then the first thing that comes into your head, maybe with a pretty quick explanation. And maybe shall we put 60 seconds on the clock?
Okay.
Yes? All right. Here we go. Pick out a present or go with a gift card.
Oh, a present. The gift cards, you know, they sit in your drawer and devalue. I've got a lot of them. If anybody wants them, give me a call.
Okay. Contract, cell phone plan, or pay by the minute?
Wow, that's a tough one. I would have to go with, well, it just depends on your habits. I'm sorry. Some talkers, you got to go with the contract and you'll really fleece the phone company. But I've told my parents to go with pay by the minute because they just don't use the things very much. And so in their case, the cell phone company is fleecing them.
All right. Buy a share of Apple or a treasury bond.
Oh, boy. Treasury bonds right now are all risk, no return. So frankly, I'd go with Apple because over the long term, I think you're going to do better than you would with a treasury bond right now. You are guaranteed to lose money for inflation over, say, 10 years.
Oh, boy. Okay. And for triple bonus points, paper or plastic?
Oh, paper. There's too much plastic in our ocean.
All right. Ding, 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 ding. Jack Otter, thank you.
My pleasure to be with you, Tess.
The book is Worth It, Not Worth It, and we'll have a link to that on our website. Thanks again.
Anytime.
And here's a decision for you. Imagine you're a Hollywood star and presumably rather well compensated. Well, with your downtime, you could take a fancy vacation, maybe work on a film or a play. Hill Harper takes a different path. He is a star of the TV crime show CSI New York, but in his off hours, he has written 4 books, including one on personal finance called The Wealth Cure. And he joins me now in studio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Now, I know this is the paperback issue of a book that came out quite a while ago, but I have to ask you, why does someone like you take an interest in telling people about personal finance?
Well, you know, it's funny. I went to Brown undergrad and before I went to Harvard for grad school, and I studied economics and sociology, and I was always interested in the way money and the way we live, how those two things link. And I think that as I've been working with through my foundation and all the people I come into contact with, the more I talk about what people care about, it's money. What stresses people out? Money. What's the number one thing that people argue about in terms of their relationships? Money. And so money occupies this huge space in many of our lives, most of our lives, yet many of us have an unhealthy relationship to money. And I wanted to really explore that, and I include myself in that. It's not that I'm the expert. What I am is the explorer, hopefully with the reader, exploring this unhealthy relationship to money and wealth.
What is your relationship to it?
Well, hopefully it's better after writing a book called The Wealth Cure, because people hear the title, they say, The Wealth Cure? I don't want my wealth cured. I want my wealth injected, you know. So, you know, this idea of curing an unhealthy relationship to money is something that is very fundamental. My book is about the marriage of health and wealth and overall well-being in terms of your life and coming up with a healthier relationship to money. That's why it's called The Wealth Cure.
Well, let's talk about the wealth virus,
yes.
Which is not the part of health and wealth that we want. So what did you mean by that when you talk in the book about this wealth virus?
Well, what I meant by that is that most of us have been taught the wrong thing about money. Most of us have been taught, first of all, that money is a result, not that money is what it really is. It's an actual tool to be used to create the life, the world, the community, the family, etc., that we want. It's a tool. And so what happens is when we're taught that it's a result, we're chasing something that's a false positive, really. So it's a virus. It becomes a virus. Like, I start wanting it and needing it and wanting more and I need more. And since it's false, in other words, you're attempting to use something as a result to fill a hole, you want more and more. It's almost like an addiction, a viral addiction.
You say in the book that it's actually an exercise in courage to save money. What do you mean by that?
Yes, because ultimately you're not buying into societal forces. You know, there are so many pressures and pushes to run up debt, to use your credit card in instances and situations where you shouldn't and you don't need to. I'm very clear about – I have a debt rule. I believe that the debt is only allowed in two cases in your life. Investing yourself in terms of education, training, et cetera, or investment in terms of real property ownership.
Mm-hmm. A mortgage.
And mortgage and or investment property or investment in business. You know, in other words, a small business loan or what have you. I'm a big believer in not all dollars are created equally. There's smart dollars and dumb dollars. Too many of us are spending too much of our money on dumb dollars, and I don't care what your income level is, whether it's your minimum wage earner or your maximum wage earner. Most of us spend most of our money on dumb money and not smart money.
Why is financial literacy important to you?
It's so important because it's the number one excuse that I hear when I ask people about their life and their dreams and their goals, and they tell me why they aren't living the life they want to live. By far. Money is the number one thing couples argue about. Money is the number one thing that people say causes them stress, their bills, their debt, etc. And it's also the number one thing that people say is what's keeping them from actually living the life they want to live. So if money is that number one thing, if it's that root cause of stopping you from living that life, stopping you from building communities the way you want to see them, stopping us from having the families, the schools, all of these things that we're hearing people talk about at these different conventions, all the politics, if money occupies that huge space, we need to deal with it in an honest way. Let's have a real conversation about it. Let's figure out why we have an unhealthy relationship to it, and let's get healthy. Let's have a wealth cure.
Hill Harper is the author of The Wealth Cure, Putting Money in Its Place, and you also may have caught him on a little series called CSI New York, where he plays Dr. Sheldon Hawks. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
And I spoke with Hill for a lot longer than 5 minutes. You can hear an extended version of the conversation at marketplace.org. Talked quite a bit this hour about choices, what investments to make, what car to buy, whether or not to cry at work. But there's one area of American life where options are shrinking fast, and that is paying for college. As college costs rise, students are finding they have no choice but to take out loans, loans that are often shockingly high and which follow you to your grave. Ron Lieber joins us now. He wrote a story in the New York Times recently about the difficulties of discharging student debt. Welcome back.
Always good to be here, Tess.
Let's start by just reminding folks, first of all, why it's so hard, pretty much impossible, to discharge student loan debt from bankruptcy.
Well, we're talking about two kinds of debt here. There's the federal student loan debt that's backed by the federal government and ultimately taxpayers. And then there's the so-called private student loan debt that comes from for-profit banks or other issuers like Sallie Mae, which is the biggest example. And the big idea here, as with any debt, is that they want to encourage you to pay it back. And the issue with students in particular is that when they graduate, they often have no assets at all and potentially a negative net worth. And so the reason why it's made so much tougher for students than it is for other people is that they know that, you know, theoretically, students could walk away from their debt and yet still keep the degrees that they borrowed to acquire.
Well, the rule here, as you note in your story, is that if you are trying to erase your student loan debt, what you have to do is prove that repaying it will cause a, quote, undue hardship. Now, this is a story you've been trying to track down for a while. Tell us why and why it's been so hard to nail down the difficulty here.
Sure. I mean, you have to go back in history to kind of figure all of this out, right? It all started with bankruptcy reform in the mid-70s. And again, back then, you know, they were really only talking about federal loans at the time because there weren't very many private loans back then. And, you know, rightfully so, legislators wanted to make sure that the federal government and taxpayers, which ultimately stand behind these loans, were protected. And so they needed to come up with a way to keep people from walking away from their debt the moment after they graduated. But they didn't want to be so stringent as to make it totally and completely impossible. So they set up this rule that said you can only walk away from your debt and get your student loan debt discharged if you can prove that paying it back would cause you what they called an undue hardship. Mm-hmm. But they never defined the term. And moreover, in a number of judicial districts, they've actually adopted this special language that the debtor needs to prove a, quote unquote, certainty of hopelessness in order to prove that their situation is likely to persist for the term of the loan. And as one lawyer put it to me, you know, the problem with the certainty of hopelessness standard is that nobody can meet it in any state that has a lottery, because if you win the lottery and if there's any hope that you're going to do that, well, then you're not hopeless.
Wow. Talk to us about one of the gentlemen you profiled in the story, Doug Wallace, 31 years old, out of Plain City, Ohio.
Yeah, so the situation with Doug was that he had diabetes. He knew that he did, but it was under control. He started college at a private university where he played football. Things did not work out for him there. He left school for a while, but eventually decided he was going to get back in and finish his degree, and he ended up at Eastern Kentucky University. And by the time he was out of school, he had tens of thousands of dollars in debt. And a year or two later, his diabetes took a bad turn, and he lost his eyesight. And eventually he was declared disabled by the federal government and filed for bankruptcy. He had a bunch of debt from credit cards and payday lenders, and he got that discharged. But by then, he had $89,000 in student loan debt, and that was not dischargeable unless he could prove an undue hardship. The situation for Doug is that it's not that it's as if he's trying to argue that blind people are unable to work. But he lives in a rural area with his father. It's the only way he's able to afford to live because he has a small disability check that he gets. And his father works all day, and it's not like his father could drive him back and forth to the vocational training he would need to become theoretically employable. Although, as Doug said, you know, he's not sure who would hire a newly trained blind man in this economic environment. So that's the situation he finds himself in as he attempts to get the bankruptcy court to discharge his debt.
So it certainly sounds like this is an onerous process with, you know, everything placed on the person who's filed to prove that essentially they have no future. But I was interested to see that you also found some folks who have done the math on this and say that more people should be trying to get their student loans dismissed in bankruptcy.
You know, as best as I was able to tell, there aren't more than 1,000 or so people who take a shot at getting their loans discharged in bankruptcy court each year. But this researcher at Princeton took a look at an enormous set of bankruptcy data that exists on you know, people who file each year. And he compared the circumstances of the people who actually got their loans discharged with the circumstances of all of the people who had merely filed for bankruptcy and had student loan debt but hadn't tried. And his best estimate was that something on the order of, I think it was 69,000 people probably ought to take a shot each year. And, you know, perhaps 20, 30, 40% of them might have some success. Right now, as we just discussed, you know, nowhere near that many take a shot at it. And it may be because many of them believe incorrectly that you literally cannot discharge your student loan debt at bankruptcy, which is often what people are told by people in the media, by debt collectors, by any number of people who don't quite understand the law.
Ron Lieber is the Your Money columnist for The New York Times. We've been talking about his recent story about school loans and bankruptcy. Ron, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Be sure to friend us on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Radio No, actually, you know what? It's Tess Vigeland these days. Next time, the drought is pushing gardeners to make tough decisions.
The costs that could be incurred by a homeowner to remove and replace a tree could run into thousands of dollars. Contrast that with, say, for instance, if you had to replace your lawn, the main costs are going to start with just a bag of seeds.
Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins and Joel Patterson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We will see you next week. This is APM.